10. I can't do this anymore. Rosa's gone. Oh, the Daleks and the Cybermen are gone too, but Rose is the most gone, because there will always be more Daleks and more Cybermen. Always. Every time he thinks he's won, they return in bigger numbers, more vicious than ever, to take something else from him. More Daleks. More Cybermen. No more Rose. Gone, 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 gone. The Doctor wants to scream, but can't seem to manage it. He feels empty. So horribly empty that before he can even face the TARDIS and the Master, he stops in one of the many Starbucks downstairs and drinks three enormous mugs of steaming tea fast. Bankers and tourists chatter nervously around him. Funny, the Doctor thinks, without finding it funny at all. The planet was invaded by two sets of alien life forms today. An hour later and the coffee shops are still open for business. People are actually smiling. Good for them, the Doctor thinks. The world moves on. He orders another industrial-sized mug of Earl Grey and drinks it more slowly. The hot tea scalds his throat, which is still tight with grief. Eventually, after the fifth mug, he stands and walks back to Torchwood Tower. A squadron from UNIT have arrived to clean up the mess, and the men standing in the main doors wave him through without asking for his name. The Doctor wonders what the cover story will be this time, but can't bring himself to care. The TARDIS is where it left him. The TARDIS is where he left it. Again, the UNIT guards step aside for him, no questions asked. Someone high up must know he's here. Spotted the police box, presumably, must have spread the word. The Doctor unlocks the door, steps inside, shuts the door again. He throws his coat over one of the archways. There's a top of roses still hanging over the railings which he brought in this morning to get his opinion, not that she took it when he gave it, and left there. The Doctor doesn't move the top or look at it. He programs the TARDIS to take them into the vortex and goes to make himself a sandwich. He is still buttering the first piece of bread 20 minutes later when the Master asks, "And how was your day?" from the doorway. "Bad," the Doctor says. He stares at the failed sandwich in front of him without seeing it. "Bad. It was bad. Cybermen, Daleks, lots of Daleks. It's all right," he adds, hearing the minute, shuddered, false breath behind him. "I got rid of them. Won't you..." He clears his throat. Watching the screens, the news. "Difficult as it may be to believe, I do occasionally find things to occupy myself with while you're away," the Master says without moving. "Those things do not always involve peering at the display screens in the hope of seeing your face." He pauses. "I notice, Doctor, that we are currently in the vortex sans companion. Can it be that Rose has decided the life of a time traveller is not for her after all?" "No," the Doctor says. "No?" "Trapped," the Doctor says thickly, "with her mum and Mickey, trapped in another universe." He takes a breath and hears it emerge as a high-pitched sob. That sob leads into another and another until he is quite definitely sobbing, loud and embarrassing, his entire face crumpling in on itself, taking in shuddering breaths when he can. Everything hurts and the Doctor leans against the worktop as his body finally gives in, his arms shaking. He turns at the light pressure of a hand at the small of his back, a quiet, firm, "Doctor," and leans against the Master, weeps into the other man's shoulder. He feels absurd, a stupid child seeking comfort from a mass murderer. The Master doesn't hold him, but he doesn't draw away, and that is enough, actually. That is all right. After an unidentifiable length of time, the Master says, "Stop this now," and the Doctor pulls himself together and obeys. It's not like the Master has any real hypnotic power anymore, but it's difficult to remember that sometimes, and he does need to stop. He breathes in, smooths down the fabric of the Master's shirt creased in his earlier grip. Breathes in. The grief is still there, fluttering at the back of his throat, but he feels in control of it now, and he's beginning to have ideas. "Good," the Master says softly and not unkindly. He puts a hand to the Doctor's jaw and pulls him gently into a kiss, which tastes of snot and any tears the Doctor hasn't already wiped into the Master's shirt. Despite this, it is a good kiss, a relieving kiss. One of the Master's hands around his jaw, the other at his waist, holding him together. When the Master draws back, the Doctor feels collected enough to talk to him again. "I've got a plan," he explains thickly. "No, don't worry," he says, attempting a weak smile when the Master raises his eyebrows. "You'll like it. I'm going to blow up a sun."
"I see," the Master says carefully.
"Why?"
"There are still gaps between the universes," the Doctor explains. "If I can crack one of them open just a tiny bit with, say, the force of a supernova..."
"Oh, Doctor, don't be absurd," the Master says, his features creasing with amusement briefly, before they reset into thought.
Even assuming you managed to locate one of these gaps, you would hardly be able to pilot the TARDIS through it. You could perhaps project an image of yourself, but for 2 minutes, 3 minutes at the absolute maximum. The Doctor nods. Exactly. Long enough to say goodbye. I've never been very good at them, but I think... You think? The Master repeats. Yes, the Doctor says as the Master turns away. I think, Master, that... Doctor, the Master says, turning back suddenly. This body is new, and it has clearly yet to develop any coping mechanisms, so I'll forgive you your hypocrisy, for your self-absorbed grieving process, and for the insult, which I'm sure you aren't even aware of, just as I have always forgiven you. What? The Doctor says. Renette Poisson, the Master says. Mickey Smith, Jack Harkness, Adam Mitchell, Lucy Miller, Charlotte Pollard, Grace Holloway. You'll notice, Doctor, that I'm listing them in reverse order. I find it easier to keep track of them this way. Dorothy McShane. What? The Doctor says again. Master, this isn't about any of them. Rose was just another human, the Master says, as though this settles the matter. What? The Doctor says again, when he can say anything at all. The Master sighs irritably. That was badly phrased, he says. I didn't mean... Of course you did, the Doctor says. My dear Doctor, the Master begins firmly, but that is as good as an affirmation. My dear Doctor, the Master begins firmly, but that is as good as an affirmation. Without another look at him, the Doctor turns on his heel and strides out of the kitchen and down the corridor. Of course. After all this time, all the tea and the sex and the way the Master watches him while the Doctor pretends to be asleep, he is still the Master. He has tolerated the Doctor's friends because they keep him busy and they keep him safe, but at the end of the day, the Doctor can replace them as simply as he might a goldfish flushed a goldfish heaven down a toilet. Another planet, another pet shop, and there's another human waiting to be shown the marvels of the universe. Of course, it's only natural the Master would try and stop what he must see as a ludicrous exposition down into the sewers. Only natural, but that doesn't make it any less of a betrayal, and anger is much easier than misery. Leave me alone, he says coldly when the Master catches up with him. So you can detonate your son in peace, the Master asks, with the Doctor thinks a hint of a sneer. Doctor, you're behaving completely irrationally, even by your usually high standards. Go away, the Doctor says. I'll talk to you later. Doctor, the Master says, and it is at this point that the Doctor presses the only button on the remote in his pocket. Whatever it was the Master had to say is silenced as every system in his body shuts down at once. The Doctor hears the creak and the clank that is the front of the Master's mechanical face dislocating and opening, but he doesn't turn around. He is coolly aware that he has just done something terrible but to acknowledge it now would mean reversing it. Reversing it would mean never seeing Rose again. It won't be for long. The scars between the universes are healing fast. He will turn the Master back on once he said goodbye. There are only 4 stars on the right nexus points of space and time. So few, the Doctor thinks, trying not to panic when the TARDIS displays them for him. The walls are closing faster than he thought. Just 4. 3 of which are... Just 4. 3 of which are, and have to remain, the centres of life-supporting solar systems for at least another couple of billion years after they could be any use. The 4th, though, is hanging alone in the backwaters of space, light-years away from anything in any dimension. It will be enough. The Doctor works quickly and calmly, just going to the point at which the star dies naturally won't crack the universe at the right point. There are numerous crude methods of pushing the sun into supernova, of course, but they're almost certainly going to lead to problems later on, and he can't have that. Fortunately, it should be possible to enclose a star in the TARDIS temporal field and increase the speed of the generation in that small area of space. Possible, anyway, if you're a genius and the owner of the last time and relative dimension and space machine in the universe, which the Doctor is. He might lose a bit of time in the process. Rose might be waiting around for a while, but it should be possible. He hasn't done anything like this since he closed the Medusa Cascade, and that was centuries ago. It's fun, actually, if you like interdimensional logic puzzles, which the Doctor does. And after all the time engineering the process, he feels a surge of exultation as he tugs the star past the end of its life cycle. It's been about a week, as far as he can tell. He hasn't been able to bring himself to sleep in his own bedroom while he's been working, or to use the primary kitchen. Fortunately, it looks like the TARDIS has taken pity on him, and he doesn't rearrange the corridors in the night. The Doctor had wondered if she would take the Master's side in this, but he always ends up where he wants to go, except the day he finds himself in the 3rd floor billiard room, which is filling up quietly with snow. As it turns out, the heating system is easily fixable. It's built around a polygonal psychic circuit he got from a dimension dump on Gryben, which the Master must be unfamiliar with, but which the Doctor knows like the back of his hand. Better, actually, as it's a new hand. He considers fixing the circuit, but eventually decides he prefers the idea of snow billiards, thanks the TARDIS for bringing it to his attention again, and takes a different route back to the console room. Now he swings the TARDIS into the orbit of a new supernova. It's a brilliant piece of flying, and caught off guard by his own incredible skills, Doctor finds himself wishing that someone had been watching. Still, spectacular though the explosion and the flying are, they're really more of a means to an end, and the end is practically in sight now. The TARDIS dutifully harnesses the power of the sun's early death, and the Doctor feeds it back through the telepathic communication network. And with a bit of a whoop, punches through into Rose's new world. It's not hard to find her. The TARDIS locates the three people from their universe, and then homes in on the one she knows best. The Doctor lends Rose his knowledge while she sleeps. There's still a big area of her mind, opened by her contact with the TARDIS, that is more than capable of comprehending what it is she needs to know. Awake, it'll all seem a bit hazy, but that should be enough. Awake, it'll all seem a bit hazy, but there should be enough residual understanding to get her to him. The Doctor waits, and eventually they arrive. Rose, her mum and dad, and Mickey. And for a while, it is worth it. I love you, Rose manages after they've lost most of their time together. Quite right too, the Doctor agrees with a broken smile, because really, if she didn't, and he'd done this, it would be unbearable. More unbearable. And I suppose, he says, if it's my last chance to say it, oh, he has so many things he should have said earlier. He wants to tell her how fantastic she was again, because she was brilliant. He wants to explain how seeing... He wants to explain how seeing things with her made them matter more, to thank her for saving him so many times, to apologise for cheating the only time you won Monopoly and for almost leaving her in the 51st century, and for never telling her about the Master because he loves her in a way that's just as valid as the way he loves the Master. And that's what the Master could never understand. Rose Tyler, he says. And then the image of the beach dissolves and the TARDIS fades back into focus. And there doesn't seem to be any point continuing because you can't hear him anymore. The breaks have healed. That was it. The Doctor rubs his eyes with both hands and then the rest of his face. The last few days have allowed him to work through his noisy grief. It settled as a low, ever-present ache in his stomach. He feels like a grimmer man now, after this regeneration's first tragedy. Regressed, perhaps, to the man he was before Rose gave him a paper hat and fell asleep on his shoulder during It's a Wonderful Life. No second chances, that sort of a man. He feels like he can almost cope like this. The Master will be pleased. With another steadying breath, the Doctor crosses to the chronometer and winds it back a couple of thousand years. Slowly he walks around the console, checking that all the instruments are functioning correctly, and then looks up to see a woman in a wedding dress where there hadn't been a woman in a wedding dress a moment before. What? He says, and then again, what? And a couple more times as the woman shouts at him to explain something he knows is impossible, and to take her home now! She keeps shouting at him even when he does. The Doctor finds that annoying once he's stopped being baffled, and then reasonably endearing once he's stopped being annoyed. He likes Donna, and is quite willing to rescue her from the taxi-driving robot Santas when the situation calls for it. Of course, as he's hanging out at the door over a busy motorway attempting to steer the TARDIS using a long piece of very cheap string wrapped around the primary controls, it does occur to Doctor... Of course, as he's hanging out at the door over a busy motorway attempting to steer the TARDIS using a long piece of very cheap string wrapped around the primary console... Of course, as he's hanging out at the door of a very busy motorway attempting to steer the TARDIS using a long piece of very cheap string wrapped around the primary controls, it does occur to the Doctor that things would be a lot easier if his live-in lover were at the console rather than stationary in one of the corridors. But he does all right. He does better with the Huon particles and the Empress of the Rachnos, though he finds himself making mental notes to tell the Master about Moth. The reappearance of the Rachnos is just a curiosity, but the Master will be excessively amused to learn that people are manufacturing Huon particles again. They've been banned for so long that the Master was still Koshe at the time,
and was... He does better with the Huon particles and the Empress of the Arachnos, though he finds himself making mental notes to tell the Master about both. The reappearance of the Arachnos is just a curiosity, but the Master will be excessively amused to learn that people are manufacturing Huon particles again. They've been banned for so long that the Master was still Koshe at the time and was still trying to make a name for himself the slow way, through politics. He'd been the one to point out the potential danger of Huon particles to a now long-dead High Council. Of course, once he turned renegade, he'd attempted to contaminate the water of an entire planet with the same particles, but by then the Time Lords knew what they were looking for and had shut him down within minutes. Idiot. It's probably the memory of their flight... It's probably the memory of their fight about the lone Dalek that forces his hand with the Arachnos. Really, it's genocide, and in any other circumstances, but they shouldn't be here. With a multifaceted Christmas baubles and a tide of dirty water, the Doctor finishes the job the Time Lord started millennia ago and destroys the newborn Arachnos before they have a chance to hurt anyone. Then he follows Donna out of the rapidly flooding basement and they walk along the bottom of the Thames in the direction of the TARDIS, arguing about whose shoes are more likely to be ruined by the silt, until a man with a crane pulls them out. He drops them off at the TARDIS and the Doctor drops Donna off at her house. This turns out to be a mistake because she invites him in for Christmas dinner. With the Master still inactive in the TARDIS, Rose still lost, and another genocide on his conscience, the Doctor is fairly sure it's not the right time to don another paper hat and watch It's a Wonderful Life, which is probably on again. But then, what is appropriate? He's already made it snow. Find someone, Donna says as he tries to leave. I don't need anyone, the Doctor replies, which is obviously, pathetically, a lie. Yes, you do, Donna says, surprisingly gently. 'Cause sometimes... I think you need someone to stop you. She's right, of course. Donna Noble is a much wiser woman than she appears. She would have been a brilliant companion. The Doctor nods and leaves her standing in his snow. He makes a ludicrously showy exit and then jogs down to the corridor in which the Master still stands. The jog turns into a run as soon as he sees the static figure of his lover coming into view. The Master is caught like a photograph of himself, mid-stride, one arm outstretched. The only movement in his entire frame is a blur of lights inside the open front of his face. In the dull anger and dull misery of the last week, the Doctor had managed to forget how awful this is. Now it breaks his heart. He skids to a stop in front of the Master, closes the Master's face with fingers that cringe at the touch of her familiar skin in such an unnatural position, and steps back. After a moment of horrible, dead stillness, the Master blinks, and his mouth begins to form the end of the sentence he began over a week ago. Then he takes in the Doctor's altered position and frowns. "You seem, Doctor, to be considerably wetter than I remember," he remarks. "It's snowing outside," the Doctor explains, and hears the word shudder. With guilt and relief. The Master rubs his eyes and breathes out. Though of course he doesn't need to. The air he's exhaling now has been small. The air he's exhaling now has been stored in a small partition just below his left shoulder for approximately 7 days and is completely unconnected to the gentle fall of his chest. I see. I'm so sorry. The Doctor says. Thank you, Doctor, but it makes no difference, the Master says. I have one question that I would like you to answer, and then I don't want you to talk to me again. Is that clear? He pauses long enough for the Doctor to nod, and then says, How long was I, his mouth twitches, off for? Master, how long? The Master repeats, voice steely. A week, the Doctor says. He sticks his hands into the pockets of his trousers to stop them betraying his discomfort. You're off for a week. The Master nods and walks past him without another word. The Doctor closes his eyes, drops his head to his chest and breathes long, slow breaths that fill and empty his lungs. Then he turns and walks back to the console room. The console room is empty. The Doctor fiddles unnecessarily with some of the control... The console room is empty. The Doctor fiddles unnecessarily with some of the controls for a while and then wanders off to take a shower. When he gets back, the console room is still empty.
So is their bedroom. So are the kitchens, the recreation rooms, the bathrooms, both swimming pools, the gardens, the Zeppelin hangar, the zero room, the croquet pitch, the library, the... In fact, all the doctors... When he gets back... When he gets back, the console room is still empty. So is their bedroom. So are the kitchens, the recreation rooms, the bathrooms, both swimming pools, the gardens, the Zeppelin hangar, the zero room, the croquet pitch, the library, the... Well, in fact, all the rooms the doctor can be bothered to check are empty. When questions, the TARDIS lets him know the master is still on board, but won't divulge anything further. Taking sides at last, the doctor grumbles and goes off to sleep in his own room if the master isn't going to. The next morning, he makes a rough tour of the TARDIS and discovers he has a present wrapping room and another room in full... The next morning, he makes a rough tour of the TARDIS and discovers he has a present wrapping room and another room full entirely with statues of Peri, which the poor girl must have been given by various amorous suitors and tribes who wanted to worship and then ritually sacrifice her. He doesn't find the master. The master doesn't reappear the next day, either. The doctor wanders the corridors, half expecting to find the master waiting like the Tin Man without his oil can. But there's no one there, again. He tries to make a few repairs to the ship, but the master's fixed everything already. So the doctor fiddles around in the lab instead, creates a variety of squeezy soap that doesn't smell completely terrible, and goes to sleep on the left-hand side of the bed, which tragically still smells a bit like the absent master. The TARDIS picks up a distress call early the next morning. It's from a tiny world the doctor has never even been to before, populated by a race of people who look uncannily like Kermit the Frog. The Kermits, who are actually known as Debenemes, are rapidly running out of water. Their giant lakes dried up suddenly during the night about a week ago, and they've been surviving on old bathwater and increasingly expensive bottled water shipped in by the Evian Company ever since. Accompanied by one of the young frog people, the doctor scrambles down in the empty basin of Lake Wargar, the closest lake to the landing site, and quickly locates the concealed entrance to the series of Accompanied by one of the young frog people, the doctor scrambles down into the empty basin of Lake Wargar. Accompanied by one of the young frog people, the doctor scrambles down into the empty basin of Lake Wargar, the closest lake to his landing site, and quickly locates the concealed entrance to a series of metal-lined tunnels. At the bottom of these tunnels is a huge reservoir, owned, according to a large stenciled sign, by the Evian Company. A few minor technical modifications and a good smack with a metal bar, he's convinced them. A few minor technical modifications and a good smack with a metal bar convince the suction pump that it wants to expel the water back into the lakes. The doctor and his Debeneme friend Herbie ride the water back up the tunnels, popping out on top at a dizzying speed and splashing down, laughing and shrieking in the newly reinstated Lake Wargar. The doctor tries to slip away during the party in his honour, only to find the TARDIS door locked from the inside. He knocks politely, then shrugs and wanders back to the party. 3 hours later, he tries again, but the door is still locked. "This isn't funny or clever," the doctor informs the closed door. "Let me in!" He hammers on it, rather less politely than last time, but neither the door nor the master respond. Instead, a deferential voice asks, "Are you all right there, Mr. Doctor?" from behind him. "Yes," the doctor says wearily, stepping back from his ship and turning to the diminutive. "Yes," the doctor says wearily, stepping back from his ship and turning to the diminutive Herbie. "I think I'm sleeping on the proverbial couch tonight, though." "Oh, well, you can stay with me if you like," Herbie suggests. "That would be," the doctor says, "in your pond." "Thanks to you," Herbie agrees happily. "Come on, I'll show you where you can sleep." The doctor spends a rather damp night in Herbie's above-pond-level conservatory, and in the morning the TARDIS doors open when he twists his key in the Yale lock. Unfortunately, there is a large white space behind him instead of the console room, but as luck would have it, the doctor recognises the effect as a rather obscure desktop theme, a joke setting with which to confound and delight your friends. Time Lords, as a rule, had a rubbish sense of humour. He closes the door and walks slowly towards what ought to be the middle of the room. Sure enough, his open palm meets the hard edge of a hexagonal console about 20 paces in. The desktop settings are controlled using the main computer, which lights up obediently in midair when the doctor locates the right keyboard with his hands. It's too easy, of course, and so the doctor isn't at all surprised when a dialogue box pop.
It's too easy, of course. And so the Doctor isn't at all surprised when a dialogue box... pops up reading, "Nice try." Oh, fuck off. He is surprised, though, when the entire computer immediately shuts itself down once he's read the message. Very impressive. The Master clearly has almost total control of the TARDIS. With the computer down, he has to make his modifications manually. In the hilarious invisibility mode, this is difficult, but not at all impossible, given the number of times the Doctor has had to make his modifications to his ship in his past. No. With the computer down, he has to make his modifications manually. In the hilarious invisibility mode, this is difficult, but not at all impossible, given the number of times the Doctor has had to make modifications to his ship in the past. There are several standard roundels in the wall, which are the standard distance from the console. The Doctor locates the correct one, opens it and tugs the invisible power lines loose. By reversing the polarity, he jump-starts the backup computer. Then all the lights go out. "Oh, come on!" the Doctor exclaims. "All right," he mutters when this fails to have any effect. "What next?" At least the backup computer is on now. Probably on. He works his way over to the console and carefully removes one of the three mallets from underneath it. The trick is, obviously, to be unexpected. The Master will expect him to work on the problem of the lights or the desktop. "Well," the Doctor thinks, easing the handbrake up with the normal... No. "Well," the Doctor thinks, easing the handbrake up with a non-mallet hand... He won't expect this. In three quick mallet strokes, he takes out the circuits controlling the dimensions of the three places the Master is most likely to be lurking. His study, the bedroom, and the second floor corridor with all the useful roundels. At the same time, he pushes the TARDIS into flight and with his foot depresses the lever that will force all the internal doors open. Light from the corridors leading off the console room emanates in 5 points in the darkness. The Doctor grins as his hands appear in the gloom. With the sound of the time rotor wheezing normally in his ears, he activates all the autopilot safety measures, reaches around with a mallet to give the acceleration a thumping boom, and spins the chronometer on another 5 million years. Another mallet thump changes the destination galaxy. A swipe of his other hand takes out all the switches controlling altitude. Just before landing, he pushes through the navigational circuits, which the Master still doesn't have access to, thank God, and into the main computer. Rerouting the power from the forced acceleration, he kickstarts the computer, manually dematerializing on what he really hopes is a barren asteroid as he does so. With a flicker of light, the TARDIS restarts, defaulting to its factory settings. Clean white roundels, a comforting low-level light, and oh yes, isomorphic controls, keyed into the genetic code of the current pilot. "Ha!" the Doctor shouts, withdrawing his hands from the restored console with a flourish. He waves the mallet sternly in the direction of the ceilings. "Now don't try anything like that again. You can't, anyway. I've locked you out. Of everything. Come and talk to me if that gets boring." Then he grins, because he's won, and because he wants to be... Yeah, that's right. Then he grins, because he's won, and because he wants to be infuriating, and because he hasn't had as much fun as this since his unit days when the Master came to bother him with the Axons and the Sea Devils. "Right," he says, ruffling his hair, which is a bit flat, thanks, in large part to the humidity of the conservatory. "I'm going to have a bath." There isn't any hot water. Propped behind the taps is a note in the Master's handwriting which reads, "Nice try." On cue, the lights go out again. Over the next couple of weeks, the Doctor gets better at foiling the Master's various revenge strategies, but the randomizer continues to evade him. It's definitely wired into the TARDIS's mainframe somewhere, but the Doctor has searched the entire thing manually and digital, and it's also definitely not. To make matters worse, the scanner is on the blink again, and so he steps out onto most of the randomly selected worlds with absolutely no idea where he is. Most of the planets are fine. Interesting even, populated with interesting people, some of whom the Doctor might have happily asked to come with him if there wasn't a strong chance the Master would murder them while they slept. Some planets are at war, which is less convenient. Some are dangerously low in oxygen, which is even less convenient. And some of them, like the one the Doctor is currently on, turn out after a while to be Trall, home of the ravenous bug bladder beast, which is bad, very bad. Shielding himself with his coat in an attempt to convince the creature that he isn't there, the Doctor legs it back to the TARDIS.
Then he falls over a tree stump. He's up and running again almost immediately, but the fall has distracted him and he's forgotten about the coat. There's a deafening roar and the doctor has time to think, "Oh, it can see me again," before the beast's claw rip into his right thigh. Ignoring the incredible pain and the gaping hole in his trousers, he pulls his coat up over his face before the beast can go for his throat. There is a pause. The doctor risks a peek round the side of his collar at the monster. It's looking around in stupid confusion. After a moment, it wanders back the way it's come, looking particularly mournful to have lost sight of its prey so late in the game. Limping now, the doctor returns to the TARDIS, fumbles with his key, and collapses on the floor, laughing. It takes him a moment to realise that the floor has taken the form of grating, part of his old coral theme, rather than the pink zebra-striped shag pile carpet it had been this morning. Then, from the console, the master says, "Pathetic. Absolutely pathetic." "You think?" the doctor asks. "Yep, this is his coral theme, all right, exactly as he remembers it, down to the grime in between the lattice grating." The master is reading a book in the jump seat, feet propped up against the bronze console. The doctor shakes his head with a smile. "Most people get eaten, I did quite well, only..." He attempts to stand and growls at the pain, "getting my leg really ripped off." Without looking up from his book, the master throws him a sealed syringe packet. It's a large dose of morphine. At least, it appears to be. It could always be something nasty that the master has cooked up in his free time, but the leg is more painful than the doctor had given it credit for earlier. He's willing to take the chance that the syringe is what it appears, an offer of truce. Leaning back against the door, he rips open the packet with his teeth, pulls off the protective covering, gets rid of the excess air, and stabs the needle into his exposed thigh. A wave of calm washes through him as the drug enters his system. The doctor breathes out. "Thank you." "Perhaps, Doctor," the master says, "you should consider acquiring another companion before you manage to kill yourself entirely." The doctor huffs a short laugh, still propped up against the door of his ship. The master takes his feet off the console, closes his book, and looks up at the doctor at last. "And potentially another suit," he adds. The doctor's eyes widen. "Well, I love my suit." The master favours him with a slight smile. "I'm sure you could learn to love another suit," he says, standing. "Blue," he adds as an afterthought at the door, "would become you very well." "Not going to help me to the medibay, then?" the doctor calls after his retreating figure. "No, my dear doctor, I am not," the master says, which the doctor takes to mean that, in some obscure way, he's been forgiven.